This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Earlier today, we learned that the Cambridge-based car-sharing company Zipcar, which has spread around the country and around the world, is now being acquired by Avis for about $500 million. So to talk about this big deal for our area is Peter Cohan, lecturer at Babson and author of Hungry Startup Strategy, and Howard Anderson, a lecturer in entrepreneurship at MIT. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
So, Howard Anderson, let me start with you. This is a fascinating deal because Zipcar has really had trouble making money. They're everywhere, but they've had trouble making money. Is it a good deal?
It's a good deal for both of them. Avis usage peaks during the week. Zipcar peaks on weekends. So the first real advantage you have is fleet optimization. So the cost of running that fleet should go down for both of them.
And Peter Cohan, how does this feel to you? I mean, this is a stock that closed at the end of December, and I believe something like $8 a share. Now at 12, I mean, it has gone up 50% on this deal. Do you think Avis is overpaying for Cambridge-owned Zipcar?
Well, not really, because it went public in 2011 at 18, and it's way below the IPO price. So the way I look at it is that $500 million or $491 million that they paid is a drop in the bucket for a company of the size of Avis. But I think there's some really significant challenges in terms of integrating the cultures of the two companies, because I think that the way they operate is so different, and the mindset and the target customer group is very different. So I think if they run the risk of losing the ability to pay attention to the needs of a very different group of people, namely young people, urban people, people who want to go shopping on the weekends and otherwise don't need a car, as opposed to business travelers who are the big customers of Avis budget.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the stock price, because this is a stock price for Zipcar that peaked near $30 a share. And even up 50% on this huge buyout news, it's still only at about $12 a share. So I want to ask both of you, but I'll start with Peter Cohan first. What has happened to Zipcar in terms of its success? Why did people think it had so much promise? And then, boy, it didn't turn out that way, at least as far as the stock goes.
Well, it's the beauty of any unprofitable company, which there are plenty of them that managed to go public, is that you can make up any story you want. There's no track record of profitability, so you can always say, well, if it just does this, it's going to be a tremendously valuable company. And you can just make, it's like biotechnology companies, which are even worse, which not only lost money but also had no revenue, is that a stockbroker or a stock salesman can say anything they want about the prospects. People get overly excited about it, particularly if they use the product and they think it's an interesting product. So this is what happened with Facebook. People don't really understand the business model, but they do understand the product. It's easy to explain, and people get overly excited about it.
Howard Anderson, is this people getting overly excited about this idea of sharing cars?
Remember that in some respects, when you look at this company, it's got a wonderful brand name among those who are going to be future Avis customers. People really like it. It's got kind of the same allure that Costco has. It's a very convenient place. They have made it very convenient to use. You can see, for example, that if you are a Zipcar customer, they will send you an Avis credit card. And remember, most people wind up spending about $10,000 a year on their car. That's depreciation and everything else. That comes out to $200 a week. So when you can come in with a price of $40, $50, $60 to use it for several hours, you are getting those first customers. And if you can keep those customers as they get older and form families and whatever, it's probably a pretty good deal for Avis.
Interesting. So this may be part of a sort of overall Avis strategy where they don't even necessarily need Zipcar to turn a profit for them.
Remember that it started, you know, you're talking about two different things here. One is the concept, and two is the reality. It was a concept company. It
right.
had a good brain. It went public and rose on the concept. Reality creeps in every 3 months. And when it went from a market cap of well over a billion down to a half a billion dollars, yeah, it is relatively an inexpensive acquisition. The cost of customer acquisition for Hertz or Avis is always high. If they can drive the cost of customer acquisition, and they don't have to integrate the two companies, they can leave them separate for a long, long time and use both brand names.
Peter Cohen from Babson. Now, it looks like Enterprise, Hertz, they've all tried to get in on this idea of car sharing and not just car rental. Is car sharing the wave of the future? I mean, is there a reason everybody seems to want a piece of this particular kind of business?
Well, it's the traditional business of renting cars is extremely competitive. It's hard to make money in it. And a lot of times when people are struggling with their base business and they see something different that looks interesting, they want to jump into it and try it. But so far, nobody has figured out how to make this, you know, a highly profitable business. And I can see why, because you basically have to keep those cars being rented constantly. The more those cars are being rented, the higher the profitability. And to me, it seems like it'd be a very high cost of selling to get that capacity utilization very, very high to make a profit. So in a nutshell, I think it's something different. I don't think anyone's figured out how to make it work. One of the interesting questions in my mind is Zipcar has a kind of unique DNA, if you will, that is sort of focused on the students and the urban dwellers. And a lot of times these two DNAs don't necessarily mix, and the bigger company tends to flush out the smaller company. And so the interesting question to me is whether Avis Budget can actually learn something about managing this business and focus it separately, or whether it basically becomes something where the acquired managers leave, they get their money, and they just go and do something else.
No, it's interesting because it really has, as you say, made its mark on college campuses. It's now on more than 300 college campuses in the U.S. and Canada. It's in 20 cities. It's got 750,000 members. And I think one of the interesting questions is whether, like maybe Netflix, which is also this idea of you don't have to own the DVD, right? You can just share it with other people. We see websites now where people share luxury goods like purses. So the idea is you can have the purse for a week or two, but you don't actually have to go out and own it. Howard Anderson, is this a wave of new kinds of companies where people don't have to own something themselves? They can be part of a network of people who share it.
Absolutely. If you look at, for example, NetJets, which is at the high end of the market, where you can rent your own private jet for a certain number of hours per year instead of buying the damn thing yourself. If you look at the wireless network, if you look at cloud computing, all this is shared resource.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, John Hertz invented the rent-a-car business way back in the 20s and whatever. That was, okay, you can rent it by the day. Here you run it for 3 or 4 hours. Remember the enormous cost of parking. And for many places, the cost of parking exceeds the cost of paying off their car. In the Back Bay in Boston, $350 a month can be the cost of parking, and people leave their car there all week. So it makes an awful lot of sense. And remember, it's not how many cars you can rent, but can you rent them at the right time? If it's the middle of the week, you don't have enough cars. And if it's in the weekend, all the cars are sitting on the lot. So if they can do load balancing, which is use the Avis cars during the week and use those cars for Zipcar on the weekend, they can increase their profits but not increase their capital requirements.
It's interesting that you bring up this idea of sharing, and you mentioned when you talk about NetJets, Warren Buffett, widely acknowledged as one of the greatest investors in the world, is a partial owner of NetJets, and I think Bill Gates maybe too. So, even they, as you say, at the high end are doing some sharing.
There's an old New England expression, use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. This lets you use it but not wear it out. It lets you own it, and you really want it for the time that you can use it, not necessarily the time that you're paying when you're not using it. It makes an awful lot of economic sense. And as Peter said, this is not expensive.
And Peter Cohen, I wonder, do you think that this is going to be, you know, we think about, there's 750,000 people right now who belong to Zipcart's, an awful lot of people. Is this going to be helpful to them that Avis took it over? Or is it going to end up being a little bit of a losing situation for the customers? Because, you know, Avis has conflicting allegiances that they're interested in running Zipcar, but they're also interested in making money and running Avis.
Well, the one advantage that Avis could provide is that Zipcar runs out of cars on the weekends. If Avis can shift cars that would otherwise not be used to the weekends to meet the demands of Zipcar customers, the customers would be better off. The concern that I have long-term about this acquisition is whether Avis decides that this is really not a profitable business to be in and sort of loses interest and maybe keeps it running but doesn't have the focus on trying to improve it and make it better for the customer. In my view, a business only makes sense if it creates value for the consumer and is also profitable for the supplier. And I think this is a business where there's greater value for the customer than there is profits for the supplier. And that's, I think, fundamentally why Zipcar was unable to maintain its independence.
And also remember, if you look at Costco as a model, people belong to Costco and they pay a yearly fee, like they do at Zipcar. And this gets them into a club. It's not an adversarial relationship. So the idea, and in fact, if you look at the Costco numbers, something like 20-25% of their profits come from their membership. That's an interesting new revenue model that Avis would dearly love to exploit.
Yeah, it's Netflix has a little bit of that membership model going too, instead of paying per item.
Correct. Well, one of the things I would say about Netflix, and I've talked a lot about this in my classes, that Netflix has DVD by mail. They were spectacular at DVD by mail because they could go out and they could buy those DVDs very cheaply and then rent them out and get a lot more people buying them than the cost of buying them. But then along comes online streaming, and they have to pay huge amounts of money to get sort of delayed on the best content. So they lose their bargaining power as a buyer to get a hold of the content. So my point being that just because it's easy for the consumer, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is cheap enough for the supplier of that service to get the asset that we're talking about sharing and get it at a low enough cost that it can actually make money when it rents it out to people.
Let's back up a little bit, Peter Cohen from Babs, and I know you wrote today in your Forbes blog about a trend that you see in terms of big companies coming into the Boston, Cambridge area and taking out, whether it's Google buying ITA or IBM buying Lotus, or in this case, Avis buying Zipcar, fairly large companies, but companies that maybe do not grow to their full potential and they're just taken out by another company somewhere else. What does that trend say to you, and how do you see it playing out?
Well, it seems to me that Boston and Cambridge is very good at coming up with new ideas that have a wide appeal. But in most cases, if they can even take them public, which is great when they do, but in most cases, Boston executives are unable to run a public company successfully for a long period of time and enable it to continue to grow. Particularly when you compare it to companies that get founded by Stanford graduates. I'm thinking about Google and Cisco and all these other companies that manage to continue to grow after they become public. It seems like there's something in the local DNA that is limiting our ability to manage our companies, to continue to keep them growing and remain independent.
Is it that we just don't have the infrastructure? Somehow they hit a ceiling at a certain, you know, at $300 million or $400 million or whatever their market cap is, and they say, yeah, I just can't grow anymore being in this area.
It's not the location. It's okay. The management. I think there's a limit to what management can do.
Okay, Howard Anderson, I wonder, what's your take on that?
Well, I'm one of the guys that sold my company, so I can answer that. Part of it is that some California companies keep growing, and if you look at the number of acquisitions that Cisco made, it's well over 100 now. The other issue, and Peter hit part of it, there's a whole different way of running companies, and rarely is the person that wants to do, you know, start up the company, get it started, and then at a certain point, you are made an offer, and I'll quote from The Godfather, that you don't want to refuse. It's just too damn good.
Yeah.
Running a company is a lot of frustration. It's pressure on quarterly profits, and someone comes and says, I can buy you out at 7 times cash flow, 20 times earnings, whatever, you know, whatever multiple it is. And often you start again, and sometimes you don't. We have, you know, and I'm also a recovering venture capitalist. We know that. We know that 75% of the liquidation events are going to be purchases, especially when the public market is closed or you need $100 million in market cap to get there. And then you can't sell for years. You can sell just a small portion. And someone comes and says, listen, I can make you an offer now that's going to be great. You can get your money out tomorrow. And you say, that's pretty good. And the venture capitalists are often encouraging you if it's a venture capital-backed company.
But do you think that there's something – do you think there's something missing in the Boston ecosystem or not necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, we had companies like Digital Equipment and Wang and all those in the mini computer industry, and they got pretty good. But in the end, Digital got bought by Compaq. Compaq got bought by HP. And management pretty much we did not grow that next generation of management here who wanted to continue and continue to build great companies.
It's interesting, Peter Cohen, you say that one of the interesting things is that these big companies, the Googles and the Amazons, they may be headquartered elsewhere, but they also see a need to have a foothold in the Boston, Cambridge area. We actually have heard just in the last couple of days that Giant Glass, which is advertised, of course, all the time based in North Andover, may be taken out by Safelite, a much larger company.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what do you make of the fact that these companies seem to leave the area, but then the big companies also want a foothold in the region?
Well, this is the thing that I think is good. You know, I worked in Kendall Square. I studied at MIT back in the early 80s. There was hardly anything there compared to what it is now. I go down there now because my daughter lives in Cambridge nearby, and I'm just astounded by the number of new buildings and the amount of additional space. And what's going on here is that the MIT students are quite simply the brightest students in the world. And people who graduate from MIT, a lot of them want to live and work in Cambridge. And so if these companies that include both IT companies like, you know, Google and Amazon and IBM and Microsoft, if they want to employ that those highly talented people, then they have to build a world for them where they can kind of go to MIT, go work for these companies, live in Cambridge and work in Cambridge, or they're going to lose them. And so that is a really great strength of Cambridge is that, you know, I guess Harvard is pretty good too, but you've got MIT, which I believe is a fantastic school, continues to produce the best students and the best people, and these companies are investing a lot of money. And just today, the New York Times came out with an article saying that there's $2 billion being invested in adding something like 1.5 million square feet to 2 million square feet that's already being developed right now in Kendall Square. And it's all about the intellectual capital of this area, and financial capital follows intellectual capital. And we have that even if we don't have managers who can continue to run public companies and keep them growing.
We've been talking about Avis's purchase of the Cambridge-based car-sharing company Zipcar and more broadly what we see in the Boston-Cambridge scene. And I've been talking with Howard Anderson, a lecturer in entrepreneurship at MIT, and Peter Cohen, a lecturer at Babson, and author of Hungry Startup Strategy. Thanks to both of you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
And here's Callie Crossley back in the studio. Hey, Callie.
Hey, Kara. Thanks. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. The conversation never stops at wgbhnews.org/BPR. I'm Callie Crossley. Have a great afternoon.